resisting liberty's excesses in order to preserve liberty itself. The danger of war was real, and war called for extraordinary measures, and the Sedition Act was set to expire in 1801. To Adams and his allies, the combination of foreign aliens within the United States and a brutal press calling into question the legitimacy of the administration was a possibly lethal one. Madison described the state of play well in May 1798. The management of foreign relations appears to be the most susceptible of abuse of all the trusts committed to a government, because they can be concealed or disclosed in such parts and at such times as will best suit particular views. Perhaps it is a universal truth that the loss of liberty at home is to be charged to provisions against danger real or pretended from abroad. Extreme measures seem suited to extreme times. On Thursday, February 15, 1798, Jefferson dined with Adams. The company was large, Jefferson wrote, but the two men found a moment afterward to talk. They spoke of rising prices, blaming Hamilton's bank paper, of course. We then got on the Constitution, and he said that no republic could ever last which had not a Senate, and a Senate deeply and strongly rooted, strong enough to bear up against all popular storms and passions. That as to trusting to a popular assembly for the preservation of our liberties, it was the merest chimera imaginable. In Philadelphia, Adams took the long view while addressing a crowd of demonstrators. Without wishing to damp the ardor of curiosity or influence the freedom of inquiry, I will hazard a prediction that after the most industrious and impartial researches, the longest liver of you all will find no principles, institutions, or systems of education more fit, in general, to be transmitted to your posterity than those you have received from your ancestors. This backward-looking point of Adams was so anathema to Jefferson that it agitated his mind long afterward. To Jefferson, the imperfections of life and the limits of politics were realities. So were the wonders and the possibilities of the human mind. "I am among those who think well of the human character generally," he wrote 21 months before becoming president. "It is impossible for a man who takes a survey of what is already known not to see what an immensity in every branch of science yet remains to be discovered. Astronomy, botany, chemistry, natural history, anatomy. These were branches of science worth the attention of every man," Jefferson said, adding that great fields are yet to be explored to which our faculties are equal, and that to an extent of which we cannot fix the limits. It was cowardly to think the human mind is incapable of further advances. Jefferson's vision for the United States was expansive. The work was never done, of course, however strong the performance of a particular era. The generation which is going off the stage has deserved well of mankind for the struggles it has made, and for having arrested that course of despotism which had overwhelmed the world for thousands and thousands of years, Jefferson said. A course arrested, though, was not the same thing as a course extinguished. In Philadelphia, in May 1798, a parade of about 1,200 supporters of the Alien Bill presented Adams with a statement in favor of the administration's measures against France. Adams had proclaimed May 9th a fast day, as Jefferson knew from Virginia during the Revolution such maneuvers had their uses, and violence broke out between pro-Adams Federalists and the Republicans. In his diary, Nathaniel Ames, a New England Republican, dryly noted that Adams' fast had been designed to engage powers above against the French. According to Jefferson, a fray ensued, and the light horse was called in. "I write in the morning, and therefore do not yet know the details, but it seems designed to drive the people into violence. This is becoming fast a scene of tumult and confusion." Such scenes evoked the worst aspects of his time in Paris. Jefferson was in a conspiratorial frame of mind. "I know that all my motions at Philadelphia, here, and everywhere, are watched and recorded." He feared his mail was being intercepted and read. It was a chaotic time. In July 1798, Virginia Senator Henry Tazewell said he feared the sedition law would be executed with unrelenting fury. At the same time, Jefferson anticipated the new arrival of an old foe. Alexander Hamilton was to become a senator from New York. Hamilton ultimately declined to seek the Senate seat. The madness of the scene reminded Jefferson of an elemental force, heat. "Politics and party hatreds destroy the happiness of every being here," he wrote Patsy. "They seem like salamanders to consider fire as their element." Jefferson was pressed for cash, which left him with a feeling of powerlessness. "I have not at this moment more than $50 in the world at my command, and these are my only resource for a considerable time to come," he wrote in April 1798. He was learning, too, of the tragic nature of one of his sister's marriages. His sister Mary's husband, John Bowling, was apparently alcoholic and abusive. "Mr. Bowling's habitual intoxication will destroy himself, his fortune, and family," he wrote to Polly. "Of all calamities, this is the greatest." Jefferson was practical, even cold about the matter. "I wish my sister could bear his misconduct with more patience. It might lessen his attachment to the bottle, and at any rate would make her own time more tolerable. When we see ourselves in a situation which must be endured and gone through, it is best to make up our minds to it, meet it with firmness, and accommodate everything to it in the best way practicable." In a letter dated January 22, 1798, Patsy announced the death of Harriet Hemings, the 2-year-old daughter of Jefferson and Sally Hemings. Patsy made no allusion to the little girl's parentage. Later in August 1799, Dolly Madison visited Monticello. Jefferson composed a letter for her to take to her husband. It spoke of many things: an order of nails from the Monticello factory, the art of plastering, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. Jefferson did not mention a significant piece of domestic news, for secrecy forbade it. Sally Hemings was pregnant with another child. The unnamed daughter, who was not to live long, was born in early December 1799. Politics remained raw. "The XYZ fever has considerably abated through the country, as I am informed, and the alien and sedition laws are working hard," he said in October 1798. "I fancy that some of the state legislatures will take strong ground on this occasion. At least this may be the aim of the Oliverians, while Monk and the Cavaliers, who are perhaps the strongest, may be playing their game for the restoration of His Most Gracious Majesty, George III. In a contentious crisis, here again was the language of the English Civil War and its royalist outcome. The allusions were directly drawn from the 17th-century drama. Oliverians were Republicans, and Monk was a nobleman who backed the restoration of Charles II, as did the Cavaliers. Jefferson's point is explicitly made. He feared there were modern-day monarchists seeking to return an English king to power, in this case, George III. The prosecutions under the new laws were egregious. Republican editors were arrested, indicted, and tried for publishing pieces the Adams administration deemed seditious. Among the most notable cases were those of Benjamin Franklin Bache of the Aurora in Philadelphia and James Thompson Callender of the Examiner in Richmond. Editors were not the only targets. Vermont Congressman Matthew Lyon, that rare creature, a Republican from Federalist New England, was charged with sedition for a letter he had written to the Vermont Journal protesting the sedition law weeks before it was even signed. In strong but hardly traitorous terms, Lyon had denounced President Adams for the president's alleged continual grasp for power, unbounded thirst for ridiculous pomp, foolish adulation, and selfish avarice. Of Irish descent, Lyon was attacked by Federalists as a seditious foreigner who may endanger us more than 1,000 Frenchmen in the field. Driven by Republican zeal, Lyon was indicted, tried, and convicted in a trial presided over by the Washington-appointed Federalist U.S. Supreme Court Justice William Patterson, who sentenced Lyon to 4 months in jail and fined him $1,000 with these words: "Matthew Lyon, as a member of the federal legislature, you must be well acquainted with the mischiefs which flow from an unlicensed abuse of government. Jefferson was distraught. I know not which mortifies me most, that I should fear to write what I think, or my country bear such a state of things, Jefferson wrote. Yet Lyon's judges are objects of national fear. Lyon himself found strength and vindication in the conviction. He reported to jail, sought re-election to the House from prison, and won. For Jefferson, the Alien and Sedition Acts were a cause of both near despair and wonderment. What person who remembers the times and tempers we have seen could have believed that within so short a period, not only the jealous spirit of liberty which shaped every operation of our revolution, but even the common principles of English Whiggism would be scouted, and the Tory principles of passive obedience under the newfangled names of confidence and responsibility become entirely triumphant, he wrote New York Chancellor Robert R. Livingston. Never one to stay out of the fray, Jefferson privately lobbied Republican candidates to run for office. In early 1799, he pleaded with John Page to seek a congressional seat. "Pray, my dear sir, leave nothing undone to effect it, for even a single vote may decide the majority in the makeup of the House." More dramatically, Jefferson secretly drafted resolutions for the state legislature in Kentucky, protesting the Alien and Sedition Acts. Madison did the same for Virginia. The Vice President of the United States was thus at work on an official rebuke for one of the American states to send to the President of the United States. The Kentucky draft was a purely Republican document, though Jefferson went far down the path to endangering the Union he loved so. In the resolution, he endorsed the idea of nullification, the right of a state to refuse to comply with federal laws that it deemed unconstitutional. Here was the great advocate of a stronger, more effective national government proposing a mechanism for chaos and almost certain disunion. Viewed in terms of philosophy, the contradictions between Jefferson the nationalist and Jefferson the nullifier seem irreconcilable. Viewed in terms of personality and of politics, though, Jefferson was acting in character. He was always in favor of whatever means would improve the chances of his cause of the hour. When he was a member of the Confederation Congress, he wanted the Confederation Congress to be respected. When he was a governor, he wanted strong gubernatorial powers. Now that he disagreed with the federal government, though an officer of that government, he wanted the states to have the ability to exert control and bring about the end he favored. He was not intellectually consistent. But a consistent theme did run through his politics and statecraft. He would do what it took, within reason, to arrange the world as he wanted it to be. John Breckinridge, a Kentucky Republican and Speaker of the State House, reported that the Kentucky Senate had balked at the nullification language. "In the Senate," wrote Breckinridge, "there was a considerable division, particularly on that sentence which declares a nullification of those acts by the states to be the rightful remedy." On reflection, Jefferson confided his faith in a middle course to Madison. "I think we should leave the matter in such a train as that we may not be committed absolutely to push the matter to extremities, and yet may be free to push as far as events will render prudent." If Jefferson had overreacted with his talk of nullification, he was coming to a more settled view of the nature of faction. In every free and deliberating society, there must, from the nature of man, be opposite parties, and violent dissensions and discords. And one of these, for the most part, must prevail over the other for a longer or shorter time, he wrote John Taylor in June 1798. "Perhaps this party division is necessary, to induce each to watch and debate to the people the proceedings of the other. A little patience, and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolve, and the people recovering their true sight." The last years of the 18th century were unhappy ones for Jefferson, but he never despaired. He knew politics was an intimate enterprise, and he took care to assuage his foes where he could. "No one can know Mr. Jefferson and be his personal enemy," said Supreme Court Justice William Patterson, who had presided over the Lyon sedition trial. "Few, if any, are more opposed to him as a politician than I am, and until recently I utterly disliked him as a man as well as a politician. Then the two men had occasion to travel together, talking and getting a sense of each other. I was highly pleased with his remarks, Patterson said, for though we differed on many points, he displayed an impartiality, a freedom from prejudice. To Elbridge Gerry, Jefferson made a testament of political faith in January 1799, writing, "I am for freedom of religion, and against all maneuvers to bring about a legal ascendancy of one sect over another. For freedom of the press, and against all violations of the Constitution to silence by force, and not by reason, the complaints or criticisms, just or unjust, of our citizens against the conduct of their agents. And I am for encouraging the progress of science in all its branches, and not for raising a hue and cry against the sacred name of philosophy, and not to go backwards instead of forwards to look for improvement, to believe that government, religion, morality, and every other science were in the highest perfection in ages of the darkest ignorance, and that nothing can ever be devised more perfect than what was established by our forefathers. The first object of my heart is my own country. In that is embarked my family, my fortune, and my own existence. I have not one farthing of interest nor one fiber of attachment out of it, nor a single motive of preference of any one nation to another, but in proportion as they are more or less friendly to us." Still, Jefferson was not overly dreamy. He solicited friends to author a tax on the alien and sedition laws, among other measures, and discussed public opinion strategies with Madison. The public mind was open to the Republican case, Jefferson said, which made him sensible that this summer is the season for systematic energies and sacrifices. The engine is the press. He sent Republican pamphlets to Monroe to promulgate. "I wish you to give these to the most influential characters among our countrymen. Do not let my name be connected with the business." On another occasion, he asked the chairman of the Virginia Republican Committee to distribute some tracts. "I trust yourself only with the secret that these pamphlets go from me," he wrote. Jefferson could only do so much as vice president. A decided character at the head of our government is of immense importance by the influence it will have upon public opinion, John Taylor wrote Jefferson in February 1799. Taylor was talking about the governorship, but the point applied, as he and Jefferson knew, to the presidency as well. Chapter 30. Adams versus Jefferson Redux. I should be unfaithful to my own feelings were I not to say that it has been the greatest of all human consolations to me to be considered by the Republican portion of my fellow citizens as the safe depository of their rights. Thomas Jefferson. It was not the most sophisticated of strategies, but it worked. On Monday, February 25, 1799, the Republicans in the House planned to take up petitions against the alien and sedition laws. The Federalists, with a bare but sufficient majority, caucused beforehand and decided, Jefferson told Madison, that not a word should be spoken on their side in answer to anything which should be said on the other. On the floor, when Albert Gallatin, the Swiss-born Pennsylvania Republican House leader, addressed the Alien Act and Virginia Congressman John Nicholas the sedition, the majority sabotaged the proceedings in the most elemental of ways, by drowning out the speakers. The Federalists began to enter into loud conversations, laugh, cough, etc. The din of the House was disorienting and dispiriting. The Republicans felt powerless. "It was impossible to proceed," Jefferson said. At Monticello in the Albemarle Spring, Jefferson worried that Adams was going to raise a presidential army or presidential militia, the formation of which would leave me without a doubt that force on the Constitution is intended. He believed, too, that Hamilton would be the real power behind the new regiments. "Can such an army under Hamilton be disbanded?" Jefferson wrote in April 1799. The debate turned violent. In the House, John Randolph of Roanoke, a Jefferson cousin and lawmaker, attacked the idea of a standing military establishment, referring to regular soldiers as mercenary forces and ragamuffins. The next evening, two Marines accosted Randolph at the new theater. He was, Jefferson said, jostled and had his coat pulled. As the 18th century ended, the presidential contest was the supreme battle in the war of ideas and personalities in American politics. Jefferson was determined to seek the top office again. He had seen enough of what he had called a reign of witches to underscore his conviction that republicanism was in danger. So much seemed at stake. A correspondent reported that Hamilton had led a louder cheer and toast to George III than to John Adams at a dinner of the St. Andrews Club of New York. "No mortal can foresee in favor of which party the election will go," Jefferson said in March 1800. Hyperbole was the order of the day. For Republicans, Adams was an aspiring monarch. "Americans," one Republican wrote, "will never permit the chief magistrate of the Union to become a king instead of a president." For Federalists, Jefferson was a dangerous infidel. The Gazette of the United States told voters to choose God and a religious president, or impiously declare for Jefferson and no God. Jefferson's views on religious liberty, however, appealed to many more moderate voters. New Jersey Republicans charged that Jefferson's enemies used religion as a means of assault, because he is not a fanatic, nor willing that the Quaker, the Baptist, the Methodist, or any other denominations of Christians should pay the pastors of other sects, because he does not think that a Catholic should be banished for believing in transubstantiation, or a Jew for believing in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Still, the religious refrain about Jefferson's unconventional faith was a frequent one. From the federal bench, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, a devoted Federalist, had harangued a grand jury with what Monroe reported were allusions which supported by Eastern calumnies about Jefferson. He declared solemnly that he would not allow an atheist to give testimony in court, an implied reference to Jefferson. Chase also moved to indict and try the Scottish-born newspaperman James Thompson Callender, a virulent Republican, whom Jefferson had supported financially, for sedition. The immediate cause of the charges was a little book with a high-minded title, "The Prospect Before Us, But a Slashing Style." The reign of Mr. Adams has hitherto been one continued tempest of malignant passions, Callender wrote. As president, he has never opened his lips or lifted his pen without threatening and scolding. The grand object of his administration has been to exasperate the rage of contending parties, to calumniate and destroy every man who differs from his opinions. Mr. Adams has labored, and with melancholy success, to break up the bonds of social affection, and under the ruins of confidence and friendship, to extinguish the only beam of happiness that glimmers through the dark and despicable farce of life. Jefferson told Callender that the tract cannot fail to produce the best effect. Reading it, Abigail and John Adams seethed. George Washington died in December 1799 at Mount Vernon. As solicitous as Jefferson had been to his old president in private, the two men were so far apart politically that Jefferson believed it the wisest course to remain at Monticello rather than to attend any of the many ceremonies commemorating Washington's life. Jefferson admired Washington's gifts in the art of leadership, but could not help but see the first president as what he had become, a Federalist icon whose party, Jefferson thought, was moving the United States in the wrong direction. Theirs had always been a complicated relationship. Jefferson had been dishonest about his support of Philip Freneau and the National Gazette, preferring to mislead Washington rather than force a confrontation over the Republican attacks on the first president. It was Hamilton, not Jefferson, who had emerged as Washington's political son. "Perhaps no man in this community has equal cause with myself to deplore the loss," Hamilton said after Washington's death. "I have been much indebted to the kindness of the general, and he was an aegis very essential to me." Reacting to the flood of tributes to Washington, Freneau wrote some verses to check the popular tide. "No tongue can tell, no pen describe, the frenzy of a numerous tribe, who, by distempered fancy led, insult the memory of the dead. He was no god, ye flattering knaves, he owned no world, he ruled no waves, but, and exalted, if you can, he was the upright, honest man. This was his glory, this outshone those attributes you dote upon. On this strong ground he took his stand. Such virtue saved a sinking land. James Madison was also striking somber notes about the Federalists. The horrors which they evidently feel at the approach of the electoral epoch are a sufficient warning of the desperate game by which they will be apt to characterize the interval, he wrote Jefferson in April 1800. To his sister, Martha Carr, Jefferson connected the sedition laws to the 1800 race. The batteries of slander are fully opened for the campaign which is to decide the presidential election. The other party have begun it by a furious onset on the printers, that they may have the field to themselves and allow no means to return their fire. To Patsy, he said, "Our opponents perceive the decay of their power. Still, they are pressing it and trying to pass laws to keep themselves in power." Jefferson harbored a real hope in the good sense of the people. His belief in democracy was not a pose, but a conviction. Educate the public, he believed, and by and large the majority would find its way to the right place. Now, in 1800, Jefferson was sure the madness and extravagance of the Federalists was too profound and evident to fool the voters. "The people through all the states," Jefferson said, "are for Republican forms, Republican principles, simplicity, economy, religious and civil freedom." In early May, Adams made some cabinet changes, nominating John Marshall to replace Timothy Pickering as Secretary of State, and naming Samuel Dexter to take the place of Secretary of War, James McHenry. Adams was belatedly trying to make up the ground he had lost by keeping Washington's cabinet intact, a decision that had given him less control over the government than he would have liked for much of his tenure. Adams also disbanded what Jefferson had called the presidential militia. To his son-in-law, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr., Jefferson noted that the Federalists are on the approach of an election, trying to court a little popularity, that they may be afterwards allowed to go on 4 years longer in defiance of it. On the eve of 4th of July celebrations in 1800, the Baltimore American published rumors that Jefferson had died at Monticello after an indisposition of 48 hours, a detail that, in its specificity, lent credence to the report. Several papers followed suit, and the Gazette of the United States said that the report appears to be entitled to some credit. By July 6th, the truth, that Jefferson was alive and well, was known, prompting a letter from the French economist Pierre Samuel Dupont de Nemours in New York. "I thought I had lost the greatest man of this continent, the one whose enlightened reason can be the most useful to both worlds," he wrote. "I spent several days in unutterable despair." In Sharon, Connecticut, a Federalist enclave, the Reverend Cotton Mather Smith dined in a small gathering that included Uriah McGregory, a Jefferson supporter. "I found him an engaged federal politician," McGregory said. Smith had asked McGregory if he truly wanted to see Mr. Jefferson in the presidential chair. McGregory had answered, yes, he did, prompting, with much other malicious invective, a diatribe about alleged financial and legal misconduct on Jefferson's part. The claim from Smith that Jefferson had obtained property by fraud and robbery, and that in one instance you had defrauded and robbed a widow and fatherless children of an estate to which you were executor of £10,000 sterling, by keeping the property and paying them in money at the nominal amount that was worth no more than 40 for 1. McGregory refused to believe it, and said so. Smith was adamant, replying that it was true, and that it could be proved. Writing Jefferson in July 1800, McGregory noted the uniqueness of the dinner-time attack. "I know, sir, that you suffered much abuse in this state, and from faithful inquiry, believe it to be unmerited and malicious, but never until the above instance knew that the vilest of your traducers had ventured to impeach your honesty in pecuniary concerns." He thought Jefferson should know of the charges, and he hoped to be armed with a reply. "I wish to have it in my power, sir, to publish a clear and full refutation, together with the vile assertion." Jefferson denied it all. There was no basis for the assertions, and lamented such rumors. On the whole, Jefferson had to count on the coming of a day when the false witness will meet a judge who has not slept over his slanders. In the fall of 1800, a conspiracy organized by a slave named Gabriel in Henrico County, Virginia, unraveled on the night of its execution. A sprawling effort, the insurrection would have used recruits to take over part of Richmond, Norfolk, and Petersburg. The white authorities struck back mercilessly, hanging 26 conspirators. From jail in Richmond, James Callender told Jefferson, their plan was to massacre all the whites of all ages and sexes, and all the blacks who would not join them, and then march off to the mountains with the plunder of the city. Those wives who should refuse to accompany their husbands were to have been butchered along with the rest, an idea truly worthy of an African heart. Like the warfare on Saint-Domingue, Gabriel's conspiracy underscored Jefferson's view that there was no sustainable future in a society in which blacks and whites lived freely in proximity to one another. In the wake of the Gabriel episode and a panic over slave violence in Virginia, the state's House of Delegates asked Jefferson to explore whether a foreign land might be open to receiving American blacks. An approach was made to the Sierra Leone Company, but negotiations lapsed for various reasons. Politically, in New York, Alexander Hamilton was unhappy that Republicans were doing well in his home state under the leadership of Aaron Burr. In the spring of 1800, New York election results had effectively given the Republicans, who had won what Jefferson called a great majority in their legislature, the votes they needed to carry the presidential ballot in the winter. Legislatures chose presidential electors in New York and 10 other states. In only 5 of the 16 states in the Union were the electors popularly chosen. In New York, Edward Livingston reported, there was a most auspicious gloom on the countenances of every Tory. Hamilton and his father-in-law Philip Schuyler appealed to John Jay, now governor of New York, to change the state's election laws before the new Republican majority took office, effectively overturning the verdict of the vote. It was a classic Hamilton maneuver. In times like this in which we live, he entreated Jay, it will not do to be over-scrupulous. The overriding goal, Hamilton said, was to prevent an atheist in religion and a fanatic in politics from getting possession of the helm of state. Governor Jay was unmoved. On Hamilton's letter he wrote, proposing a measure for party purposes which I think it would not become me to adopt. The Republican win in New York would stand, opening a path to the presidency for Hamilton's nemesis. On the day of the news of the New York results, Jefferson met with Adams on other business in Philadelphia. The president, Jefferson said, was very sensibly affected by the Jeffersonian victory in New York and accosted the vice president. "Well, I understand that you are to beat me in this contest," Adams told Jefferson, "and I will only say that I will be as faithful a subject as any you will have." "Mr. Adams, this is no personal contest between you and me," Jefferson recalled himself saying. To Adams, he continued, "Two systems of principles on the subject of government divide our fellow citizens into two parties. With one of these you concur, and I with the other. As we have been longer on the public stage than most of those now living, our names happen to be more generally known. One of these parties, therefore, has put your name at its head, the other mine. Were we both to die today, tomorrow two other names would be in the place of ours, without any change in the motion of the machine. Its motion is from its principle, not from you or myself." "I believe you are right, that we are but passive instruments," said Adams, "and should not suffer this matter to affect our personal dispositions." From Jefferson's perspective, however, Adams did not long retain this just view of the subject. "I have always believed that the 1,000 calumnies which the Federalists, in bitterness of heart and mortification at their ejection, daily invented against me, were carried to him by their busy intriguers, and made some impression." Jefferson was right that the Federalists were not going quietly. There was talk of fielding another potentially disruptive Pinckney of South Carolina. In 1796, it had been Thomas. In 1800, it was to be his brother Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, who would stand as a Federalist candidate along with Adams. It was the 1796 play all over again. The letter of the law said that each elector voted for two candidates, but could not designate which was for president and which for vice president. Anti-Adams Federalists, such as Hamilton, hoped that South Carolina's electors would choose Jefferson and their native son Pinckney, thus propelling Pinckney, who, combining the votes he won in Adams' states with South Carolina's votes, stood a good chance of winning the whole election, to the presidency. To support Adams and Pinckney equally is the only thing that can possibly save us from the fangs of Jefferson, Hamilton wrote a fellow Federalist in May 1800. Although Jefferson referred to the Federalists' tactics as hocus-pocus maneuvers, he could be vulnerable if everything broke Hamilton's way. Adams was under assault from all directions. In October 1800, Hamilton published an attack on the second president. Entitled, Letter from Alexander Hamilton Concerning the Public Conduct and Character of John Adams, Esquire, President of the United States, it argued that Adams did not possess the talents adapted to the administration of government, and that there are great intrinsic defects in his character which unfit him for the office of chief magistrate. Writing to the diplomat Rufus King in Great Britain, the New York Federalist Robert Troup said he thought the Hamilton-Adams division fatal to Federalist hopes. Our enemies are universally in triumph. Hamilton, however, believed there was little to lose. If we must have an enemy at the head of the government, Hamilton said, let it be one whom we can oppose and for whom we are not responsible, who will not involve our party in the disgrace of his foolish and bad measures. The fall of 1800 was the most momentous of autumns for Jefferson, a time of dizzying anxiety and exultant hopes. He was on the cusp of consummate command, of national approval, of glorious victory. The emotions of the hour were stormy. At Monticello, he fell into existential worry. I have sometimes asked myself whether my country is the better for my having lived at all, Jefferson wrote in a private memorandum. I do not know that it is. I have been the instrument of doing the following things, but they would have been done by others, some of them perhaps a little later. He listed the navigational improvements he made to the Rivanna River in his Burgess days, the Declaration of Independence, his work on the revision of the laws of Virginia, and the introduction of olive trees to the United States. Slowly but steadily, results from the states reached Monticello. Republicans were winning where they needed to win, holding the South and doing well in Pennsylvania and New York. Democratic principles seemed to be evidently increasing, said former Secretary of State Timothy Pickering unhappily. On hearing that the South Carolina ploy to elect Pinckney had failed and that Jefferson was likely to become president, a New England clergyman wrote, I have never heard bad tidings on anything which gave me such a shock. On Friday, December 12, 1800, Jefferson felt confident enough of the results to declare privately that he was likely to be the next president of the United States. I believe we may consider the election as now decided, he wrote Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. Delaware Republican Caesar A. Rodney rejoiced. He was convinced that Jefferson's election signaled the end of the tempests and tornadoes of the Adams years. Still, Jefferson's sense of fragility kept him in mind of Federalist traps. Several high-flying Federalists, Jefferson wrote Aaron Burr, have expressed their hope that the two Republican tickets may be equal, and their determination in that case to prevent a choice by the House of Representatives, which they are strong enough to do, and let the government devolve on a president of the Senate. The possibility of a tie, Jefferson told Madison in December, has produced great dismay and gloom on the Republican gentlemen here, and equal exultation in the Federalists, who openly declare they will prevent an election and will name a president of the Senate pro tem by what they say would only be a stretch of the Constitution. The month of February, therefore, will present us storms of a new character. There was much uncertainty. Some of the Jacobins are afraid Mr. Jefferson will not administer the government according to their wishes, Massachusetts Federalist George Cabot wrote Rufus King on Sunday, December 28, 1800. Others of them think it was easy and pleasant to rail and find fault, but difficult to govern and vindicate. They are unwilling to take responsibility upon themselves or friends. Others are afraid Burr will be chief. The drama was seen by some in light of the larger struggle between monarchy and republicanism. Our Tories begin to give themselves airs already in expectation of a tie. John Randolph of Roanoke wrote Representative Joseph Nicholson of Maryland on Tuesday, December 16, 1800. I fear that in this event they will give us some trouble. At the same time, I know that it will be damnatory of their party with those who are not devoted to the monarchy. Though some Federalists spoke of throwing support to Burr in exchange for political and policy concessions, the New Yorker showed no outward signs of working against Jefferson. I do not apprehend any embarrassment, even in case the votes should come out alike for us. My personal friends are perfectly informed of my wishes on the subject, and can never think of diverting a single vote from you, Burr told Jefferson. On the contrary, they will be found among your most zealous adherents. There is no evidence that Burr considered betraying Jefferson, but Jefferson soon came to believe that his running mate was an unreliable and undesirable ally. The eventual outcome of the election of 1800, Jefferson told his son-in-law John Wales Epps, passed all understanding. The president, I am told, is in a state of deep dejection. His feelings are not to be envied, wrote Timothy Pickering on Monday, January 5, 1801. To his unadvised, to use a mild term, measures are traced the evils with which the whole of our country is now perplexed and depressed. And many discerning Federalists at least doubted which was to be most deprecated, his re-election or Mr. Jefferson's elevation to the presidency. Republicans worried about a Federalist defeat of the popular will. The dread now, a correspondent wrote the Republican John Breckinridge in late December 1800, is that Jefferson and Burr are equal as the vote of the electors, and that Burr will be preferred by the eastern states, not because they think him really the most capable, but because Jefferson is the choice of the people, and their will shall not prevail. This certainly would be a wicked and contrary disposition in them. But what will they not do or attempt? The year ended in fog and mystery. The feds appear determined to prevent an election and pass a bill giving the government to Mr. Jay, appointed Chief Justice, or to Marshall as Secretary of State, Jefferson wrote Madison on the day after Christmas. Yet I am rather of the opinion that Maryland and Jersey will join the seven Republican majorities. By the last Sunday in December 1800, the votes were all in. They came to Jefferson as President of the Senate. It was a tie. James McHenry put the key question to Rufus King on the second day of 1801. Where, McHenry asked, is all this to end? Chapter 31. A Desperate State of Affairs. Rumors are various, and intrigues great. Gouverneur Morris. It is extremely uncertain on whom the choice will fall. John Marshall. The Washington, D.C. of 1800-1801 was a makeshift affair. Six or seven boarding houses were in competition with Conrad and McMunn's, where Jefferson lodged. A Philadelphia bootmaker had recently set up shop near the Capitol, as had a bookstore. Benjamin W. Morris and Company, groceries, stocked Madeira wine, brandy, and spirits, along with soap, lamp oil, and hair powder. The sides of Capitol Hill itself were still wild, wooded, and filled with game. Moving between the Senate, where he remained the presiding officer, and his quarters at Conrad and McMunn's, Jefferson tried to keep his equilibrium. It was not easy. No one knew what each day would bring. The election, Jefferson wrote a son-in-law, is still problematical. Once an ally, Aaron Burr now seemed a possible threat. On Monday, January 5, 1801, the Philadelphia Gazette wrote that Burr was heard to insinuate that he felt as competent to the exercise of the presidential functions as Mr. Jefferson. On the same day, Benjamin Hitchborn, a Jeffersonian, reported, "Some of our friends, as they call themselves, are willing to join the other party in case they should unite in favor of Colonel Burr." Jefferson's enemies were indeed at work, open to considering any scenario that would keep Jefferson out of power. There would be really cause to fear that the government would not survive the course of moral and political experiments to which it would be subjected in the hands of Mr. Jefferson, said Delaware Congressman James Bayard, a Federalist. Albert Gallatin, writing to his wife, said, "What will be the plans of the Federalists? Will they usurp the presidential powers? I see some danger in the fate of the election." Roger Griswold lamented the sorry pass things had come to. "Jefferson as a politician I believe to be the weakest of all men. He may be honest, but it is a point which is much doubted by those acquainted with his private life," Griswold said. On Sunday, January 11, 1801, Jefferson attended morning services in the Capitol. The Right Reverend Thomas Clagett, the Episcopal Bishop of Maryland and chaplain of the Senate, was presiding. Roger Griswold was there, too, and could watch Jefferson as the sermon unfolded. Clagett, with, Griswold said, more learning, perhaps, than wisdom, was trying to link some biblical prophecy to the events of the French Revolution. In doing so, Griswold wrote, the bishop was obliged to dwell at some length upon the mischief which had grown out of the visionary plans of the French philosophers. Then their infidelity was described, and the pernicious tendency of their schemes, both as they related to politics and morals, was painted in glowing colors. To Griswold's eye, Jefferson took every word to himself and thought the bishop was delivering a philippic upon his theories and visions. Jefferson blushed like a young girl of 15, and I make no doubt wished the bishop and his prophecies at the devil. Along the mid-Atlantic, Jefferson partisans considered arming themselves to march on the Capitol. The denial of the popular will, Jefferson said privately, opens upon us an abyss at which every sincere patriot must shudder. Elbridge Gerry was told, by high authority, that Jefferson's election would put the Constitution to the test. Rumors grew as days passed. Some strange reports are circulating here of the views of the Federal Party in the present desperate state of its affairs, Monroe wrote Jefferson from Richmond on Tuesday, January 6, 1801. It is said they are resolved to prevent the designation by the House of Representatives of the person to be president, and that they mean to commit the power by a legislative act to John Marshall, Samuel A. Otis, or some other person, till another election. Lawmakers in Richmond were debating whether to remain in session, Monroe said, to be on the ground to take such steps as might be deemed proper to defeat any measure that denied Jefferson the presidency. Everyone was to be watched. Unfriendly foreign ministers should be observed, wrote Tench Cox on Saturday, January 10, 1801. The professions of Federalists should not be too hastily credited. It is a case wherein we cannot fear too far if we preserve our firmness and temper. With the outcome uncertain, the Federalists struck while they could, passing the Judiciary Act of 1801 in February. If Jefferson or Burr prevailed, who knew when the Federalist interest might again have the power to act? Taking advantage of the hour, then, the Congress approved and President Adams signed a bill that increased the number of federal judicial officers, strengthened and expanded the circuit courts, and reduced the number of Supreme Court justices from 6 to 5, thus depriving any Republican president of at least one appointment. The judiciary bill has been crammed down our throats without a word or letter being suffered to be altered, wrote Senator Stevens Thompson Mason of Virginia, a Republican. Jefferson believed the law, coming so late in Adams' term, was a parasitical plant and grafted at the last session on the judiciary body, and that the Federalist appointees to the new positions had retired into the judiciary as a stronghold, and from that battery all the works of republicanism are to be beaten down and erased. Such appointees became colloquially known as Adams' midnight judges, and there were midnight appointments to lesser offices as well. The most significant decision Adams made in these months was to name John Marshall, his Secretary of State, as Chief Justice of the United States, giving a Jefferson foe lifetime tenure as head of one of the three branches of the federal government. The Federalists believed Jefferson's Republicans to be every bit as dangerous as Jefferson's Republicans believed the Federalists to be. Adams and Marshall met in January 1801 while Marshall was still Secretary of State to discuss possible successors to Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth, who was retiring. Though Adams had sought to re-enlist John Jay, the first Chief Justice, to return to the bench, Jay chose to remain in the New York governorship. "Who shall I nominate now?" Adams asked Marshall. As Marshall recalled the conversation, he told the president that he had no counsel to give. "I believe I must nominate you," Adams said. Marshall recalled being pleased as well as surprised and bowed in silence. The U.S. Senate confirmed the president's nomination in the last week of January, 1801. In the weeks after Marshall's confirmation, Republicans took care to encourage one another about the presidential election. "Mr. Jefferson is undoubtedly the rock of our political salvation, from which no concurrence of circumstances should compel us to depart," Caesar A. Rodney of Delaware wrote Joseph Nicholson on Tuesday, February 17, 1801. "We should consider ourselves as indissolubly bound to him, by a Gordian knot which no intrigue should untie and no force cut asunder." Jefferson himself was worried enough about talk of installing the president pro tempore of the Senate in the president's house that he paid a call on Adams with one subject in view, to have this desperate measure prevented by his veto. Hearing Jefferson's business, Adams flew into a temper. "He grew warm in an instant," Jefferson recalled, and replied with a vehemence he had not used towards me before. "Sir," Adams said to Jefferson, "the event of the election is within your own power," arguing that Jefferson need only commit to certain Federalist policies to end the suspense and become president. "The government," Adams said, "would instantly be put in your hands." "Mr. Adams," Jefferson replied, "I know not what part of my conduct, in either public or private life, can have authorized a doubt of my fidelity to the public engagements. I say, however, I will not come into the government by capitulation. I will not enter on it, but in perfect freedom to follow the dictates of my own judgment." "Then things must take their course," Adams said, and the conversation ended. It was a bitter, uncomfortable moment, the first time in our lives we had ever parted with anything like dissatisfaction, Jefferson recalled. Such was the season. Such were the stakes. From Pennsylvania, Governor Thomas McCain saw every possibility. Interest, character, duty, love of country, all conspired to ensure Jefferson's election. "But I have been told that envy, malice, despair, and a delight in doing mischief will prompt the Anglo-Federalists to set all other considerations at naught, and that it is intended to so manage as to keep the states equally divided, in order that Congress may, in the form of a law, appoint a president for us until a new election shall take place." Though he said he could not believe such a thing could happen, he also believed in preparing for the worst. "But should it be possible the gentleman will act the desperate part that has been suggested by the partisans of anarchy and civil war," McCain asked, "by what authority would they be acting? To install anyone other than Jefferson or Burr would be unconstitutional, an act of usurpation." McCain was clear about his intentions. "If bad men will dare traitorously to destroy or embarrass our general government and the union of the states, I shall conceive it my duty to oppose them at every hazard of life and fortune, for I should deem it less inglorious to submit to foreign than domestic tyranny." The Pennsylvania militia was to be readied, McCain said, and arms prepared for upwards of 20,000, including brass field pieces, etc., etc. The governor was also ready to issue an order for the arresting and bringing to justice every member of Congress or other person found in Pennsylvania who should have been concerned in the treason. A few fires at official buildings in Washington raised suspicions. The burning of the War Office last month and now the Treasury have probably been accidental, but as these events were predicted in Philadelphia and subjects of conversation in July last, suspicions of design will be entertained by many, McCain said. Reporting the fires at the Treasury and War Offices, Roger Griswold observed, "It seems heaven has pointed its curses against our national establishments in this city of the wilderness." The tension of the time exhausted Jefferson. "I long to be in the midst of the children and have more pleasure in their little follies than in the wisdom of the wise," he wrote Patsy. "Here, too, there is such a mixture of the bad passions of the heart that one feels themselves in an enemy's country." The House planned to meet on Wednesday, February 11, 1801, to choose a president. From Albemarle County, Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. wrote, "The approach of the 11th February makes the people here breathe long with suspense. Their anxiety is so great." As the lawmakers gathered, the mysteries only deepened. According to notes Jefferson made on Thursday, February 12th, of a conversation with Edward Livingston, there was shadowy talk of deal-making. Edward Livingston tells me that Federalist James Bayard applied today or last night to General Samuel Smith and represented to him the expediency of his coming over to the states who vote for Burr, that there was nothing in the way of appointment which he might not command, and particularly mentioned the secretaryship of the Navy. Smith asked him if he was authorized to make the offer. He said he was authorized. Bayard, in like manner, tempted Livingston. To Dr. Lynn of New Jersey, they have offered the government of New Jersey. Bayard soon shifted tack and went to Maryland Republican Congressman Samuel Smith with a proposition for Jefferson. Bayard later claimed that he explained to Smith what could be done to resolve the impasse and give Jefferson the presidency. If Jefferson would pledge not to dismiss all Federalist office holders and to preserve the Navy and the public debt, all would be well. According to Bayard, Smith went to Jefferson, received Jefferson's acquiescence, and then returned to Bayard with those answers. "This is absolutely false," Jefferson wrote later. "No proposition of any kind was ever made to me on that occasion by General Smith, nor any answer authorized by me." Smith supported Jefferson's version of events, saying that he had discussed broad policy questions with Jefferson, but had not told Jefferson why he was asking. Smith's assurances to Bayard, then, were Smith's interpretations of Jefferson's intentions, not a proffer. Did Jefferson strike a deal to win the presidency? His denials are firm, but the election was unfolding in a charged atmosphere in which no one spoke of anything else. It seems likely that Bayard believed he had sufficient assurance that Jefferson was not going to tear down the whole works of the previous dozen years. With Smith's representations, however specific or explicit they were, in mind, Bayard moved to end the drama and deliver the presidency to Jefferson. By his own account, the Federalist terms were well known to Jefferson, who had been invited at least twice, once by President Adams himself, to calm the worst of the opposition's fears. New York Senator Gouverneur Morris encountered Jefferson one day outside the Senate chamber. "He stopped me and began a conversation on the strange and portentous state of things then existing, and went on to observe that the reasons why the minority of states were so opposed to my being elected was that they apprehended that, 1, I should turn all Federalists out of office, 2, put down the Navy, 3, wipe off the public debt, and 4, that I need only to declare or authorize my friends to declare that I would not take these steps, and instantly the event of the election would be fixed." Standing on the steps, absorbing Morris's words, Jefferson replied, "I told him that I should leave the world to judge of the course I meant to pursue by that which I had pursued hitherto, believing it to be my duty to be passive and silent during the present scene, that I should certainly make no terms, should never go into the office of president by capitulation, nor with my hands tied by any conditions which should hinder me from pursuing the measures which I should deem for the public good." Jefferson knew what he was passing up. It was understood that Gouverneur Morris could have swayed another vote and decided the election, Jefferson recalled. Jefferson had similar exchanges with Adams in their meeting on Pennsylvania Avenue, and again with the Federalist Dwight Foster, who called on Jefferson at Conrad and McMunn's to seek assurances. Yet Jefferson had already said what he had to say, and that was as far as he was willing to go. "I do not recollect that I ever had any particular conversation with General Samuel Smith on this subject," Jefferson wrote. "Very possibly I had, as the general subject and all its parts were the constant themes of conversation in the private tête-à-têtes with our friends. But certain I am that neither he nor any other Republican ever uttered the most distant hint to me about submitting to any conditions or giving any assurances to anybody. And still more certainly, was neither he nor any other person ever authorized by me to say what I would or would not do." Hamilton understood this. Jefferson is to be preferred over Burr, he said. He is by far not so dangerous a man, and he has pretensions to character. Jefferson, Hamilton noted, is as likely as any man I know to temporize, to calculate what will be likely to promote his own reputation and advantage, and the probable result of such a temper is the preservation of systems, though originally opposed, which, being once established, could not be overturned without danger to the person who did it. Other Federalists agreed. Mr. Jefferson is a man of too much virtue and good sense to attempt any material change in a system which was adopted by our late beloved Washington, and has been since steadily pursued by Mr. Adams, and which has preserved our country in peace and prosperity for 12 years, during which period almost the whole civilized world has been deluged in blood. William Fitzhugh, a Virginia Federalist, who had been close to George Washington, wrote in January 1801. The voting was slow. Ballot after ballot came and went inside the Capitol. Lawmakers slept on pallets. The weather was terrible. An ailing representative, Joseph Nicholson of Maryland, was carried through the snow on a stretcher and set up in a room next to the House. His wife helped guide his hand to fill in his choice. Finally, at 1 p.m. on Tuesday, February 17, 1801, on the 36th ballot, Jefferson prevailed. Republicans thought of the Federalists as the conspirators, and Margaret Bayard Smith, the wife of the Jeffersonian editor Samuel Harrison Smith, noted how quickly the Federalists hurried to their lodgings under strong apprehensions of suffering from the just indignation of their fellow citizens for attempting to subvert the election. Afterward, James Bayard claimed New England was prepared to go without a constitution and take the risk of a civil war. Jefferson told McCain that in the event of a usurpation, I was decidedly with those who were determined not to permit it, because that precedent, once set, would be artificially reproduced and end soon in a dictator. Jefferson's public serenity and strength had been essential to inspiring Republicans to stay the course. When I look back, I cannot but shudder at the prospect which presented itself during the late contest, wrote the lawyer Archibald Stewart from Stanton, Virginia. The minds of men from extreme anxiety seemed to settle down into a firm resolution to resist every attempt to give us a president who had not been the choice of the people. I was pleased to discover this temper, as it proves our liberties cannot be lost without a struggle. The roar of cannons announced the news. In Alexandria, 32 rounds were